Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies. This is your host, Bernice Heilbrun, and I'm delighted to be able to share an interview with you today with author Karsten Schapkow. Professor Schapkow is at University of Oklahoma in Norman, usually. Today he's in Germany, and he's taken the time to podcast with us from there. His book is Role Model and Counter Model, The Golden Age of Iberian Jewry and German Jewish Culture During the Era of Emancipation, published in 2016 by Lexington Books. It's a fascinating transnational approach to German Jewry. Dr. Schapkow has some very, very interesting insights to share with us. And without further ado, I'll turn to our interview. Hello, welcome, Karsten, to New Books in Jewish Studies, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us today about the new English translation of your book, Role Model and Counter Model, The Golden Age of Iberian Jewry and German Jewish Culture During the Era of Emancipation. Let's start by perhaps you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Yes, sure. First of all, thank you very much for giving me a chance to talk about my book. So many years ago, while working on my master's thesis about the German Jewish author Ernst Toller, I came across Toller's autobiography, which opened with a reference to Toller's supposedly Sephardic origin when describing the wealth of his Sephardic ancestors during the 18th century when living in the Polish province of Posen. This made me curious. Why would an assimilated German Jew like Toller, who was well known as an independent socialist, make reference to his Sephardic descent? Now my interest was sparked. Subsequently, I wrote a dissertation on the perception of Baruch de Spinoza, another famous Sephardic Jew, in German Jewish culture. And in Spinoza's case, it was namely his Sephardic descent that made him appealing for his Jewish but also non-Jewish readers, which made him into the first modern Jew, as Yuval called it. And when I finished my monograph on Spinoza, I decided now would be the right time really to look into the, complete picture, to analyze how German Jews perceived Sephardic Jewry, mainly in Spain, during the 19th century, so during the era of emancipation of German Jewry. And that's basically what is discussed in my book, Role Model and Counter Model.
Thank you. Okay, could you start us off then on the substance of your book by describing the period in German Jewish history that's the subject of your study?
Mm-hmm. So basically, in my book, I start analyzing or describing the history of the Jews at the end of the 18th century, so before their emancipation, up to the year when German Jews became citizens in the German Empire, which was in 1871. So between these roughly 90 years, there's an ongoing discourse in Jewish and non-Jewish culture if and how Jews could become integrated or assimilated into German majority culture. So that is the framework. And in that framework, German intellectuals at the end of the 18th century, so enlightened mainly men, found an ideal situation in medieval Spain, where the Jews, in their eyes, were integrated and widely accepted. And they picked on these examples, mainly highly esteemed Sephardic philosophers such as Maimonides, to make sure it had been possible for Jews in the past to be integrated in a non-Jewish majority culture and also remain Jewish. So that is very important for the first generation of enlightened Jews in Germany at the end of the 18th century. And they basically focused on these individual characters like Maimonides, Yehuda Halevi, and also Menasseh ben Israel, who lived in the Netherlands later.
So I think you've answered the question then about why German Jews were so fascinated by Iberian Sephardic Jewish history. And you indicate in your preface that it was the fissures within German Jewish understanding of the past era of Iberian Sephardic history that played a decisive role. What do you mean by this?
Well, I mean, German Jews focused on Iberian Sephardic history because they perceived the history of the Jews on the Iberian Peninsula as some kind of a role model that in particular speaks to their own situation as being Jewish in Germany at the end of the 18th century. So Jews in Germany at the end of the 18th century, I mean, eagerly adapted the ideas of the Enlightenment. I mean, they had their own Enlightenment, the Haskalah, but they also very much went into dialogue with Christians at that time. So, and that was, of course, not ideal, their situation in Germany. They were not integrated. They were widely perceived as beggar Jews because the majority of the Jews living in Germany were complete outsiders in an economic perspective, but also in the sense that they were not integrated into the overall society. So very few elite Jews in Germany, so to speak, understood that something has to be changed in order to make Jews better integrated. And so when looking back to Spain, they believed that that actually happened already, or in the past in Spain, that was a reality, that all the Jews who lived in Spain were integrated. Of course, that is an idealization of the historic, I mean, reality, but they took that as a model to basically use for their own purpose as living in Germany and speaking to fellow Jews about the need to become integrated and accepted, because in Spain it worked out not only for the Jewish community, but also helped Spain as a country, that's always the argument, to flourish. And so that is what I mean by, I mean, it's a very ambivalent situation in Germany, and their perception is basically speaking towards this ideal, and they hope that some of the ideal is also reflecting well on their future in Germany.
That is so fascinating, and I have to admit I've used your findings when I teach my classes now, because it makes it so clear, and it seems like such a very important point. Let me ask you, did German Jews actually debate and discuss a role model for themselves? And if they did, what did this process look like, and who were the key figures?
At the beginning, when they started focusing on their own situation, there's some kind of a criticism among the maskilim, so the German Jewish enlightened thinkers and authors, who criticized mainly the Jewish educational system in the German-speaking lands. I mean, that's maybe the more precise expression I should use, German-speaking lands, because it also was a debate that took place in, let's say, Austria. And so they criticized mainly the rabbinical establishment in the German-speaking lands, and saw these rabbinical establishment as narrow-minded, only focusing on the Talmud, and not having a real sense what is going on in the real world. And of course, that also speaks to the reality, because most of these rabbinical authorities had been trained in Eastern Europe, which back then was the center of, I mean, traditional Judaism. But for someone who lived at the end of the 18th century and who believed to be enlightened and hoped to become part of the overall German society, it was necessary to develop a new kind of thinking. What is the meaning of being Jewish and also being somehow attached to the overall development in society? And so the Polish case was not a model they could rely on. So for them, something else has to be defined. And that basically, and even before the science of Judaism emerged, and that's what is one of the main points in my book, there's a huge debate in Jewish periodicals on these individuals I just mentioned earlier, like Maimonides, Yehuda Halevi, Menasseh ben Israel, who were accepted by the overall non-Jewish society because they helped to develop non-Jewish majority society. And that means, as in the Muslim world, as well as in the Christian world. Well, it always depends on perspective, but that is what these individuals did. And I mean, to be frank, it's a discourse among very few people at the beginning, I mean, at the end of the 18th century. But then it became more explicit, in particular, amongst scholars of the science of Judaism, like Leopold Sunz, who really went back to the sources, so to speak, identified the sources and came across findings where the actual, I mean, where actually Sephardic Jews participated in the overall society in Spain, Muslim Spain, Christian Spain, and he compiled these findings. And this is now, I think, the most interesting part of it. These books were not read by a lot of people. I mean, they are very difficult, very scientific. But from here, other scholars who published also as scholars on Sephardic Jewish history, they also started writing more popular descriptions of the topic. Some wrote novels, others basically poems. And always the point in here is, once there was a time when Jews were highly integrated, they participated, they spoke the language of the majority, Arabic, or later the Romans vernacular, and that also made them into this point I also focus in the book, into middlemen. Yeah? So middlemen between the majority societies, Muslim and Christian, and also towards the Jewish society.
Interesting. So they were, let me jump to a term that you use, cultural mediators. I gather from what you just explained, they were cultural mediators between the minority Jewish culture and the majority culture, as well as between the Muslim and the Christian cultures and civilizations. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I see it. And of course, many other scholars before me saw it the same way. So Jews were perceived as cultural and intellectual mediators because they were able to speak a variety of languages. And also, I mean, used, let's say, the Arabic language to a degree that they also wrote liturgical texts in Arabic. And they also appreciated Arabic lifestyle. Yeah. So Norman Stillman has termed that focus on the Arabic language as linguistic nationalism of the Sephardic Jews. And that's, of course, something if we compare it once again with Germany, because that's how I have basically contextualized my book. I do not just analyze the Sephardic history on the Iberian Peninsula, but I see it basically as a mirror to the situation of the Jews in Germany, not only during the era when these Jews in Germany wrote about medieval Spain, but also in comparison to medieval Jewish life in Ashkenaz, so in the German-speaking lands. Because here, clearly, we clearly can say that the Jews who lived in the Middle Ages in the German-speaking lands did not speak Latin as they did by comparison. They spoke Arabic in Muslim Spain. Of course, we cannot compare Latin, which is mainly a scholarly language spoken by very few people, mainly those of the clergy. We cannot compare it with Arabic, which was an overall, I mean, cultural language. But here is really the reality that for the Jews who lived on the Iberian Peninsula, in the eyes of those who wrote about them in the 19th century, that's an indication for perfect integration. Dress, language, customs were basically adapted, integrated from the Arabic example into the Jewish culture. And that's one example. But we also find, of course, Jews as mediators in terms of something which I think is different to Ashkenaz, because in Ashkenaz there are also the 18th century court Jews, very few Jews who had a chance to interact with rulers in the Christian world. But apparently the overall political impact Sephardic Jews as mediators had in Spain was much larger. So we know that very few of them became ministers, advisors to kings and queens. And that's also the downside of the whole idea, honestly, because the German Jews in the 19th century, so those who were proponents of the science of Judaism, mainly focused, at the beginning at least, of these charismatic Jewish individuals and did not talk a lot about the overall culture. And to be frank, it's also not so easy to come down with material, primary sources on that subject matter. So in the texts I studied, first of all, individuals like Maimonides were discussed and analyzed and idealized, and later it a little bit became a little bit more encompassing and talking also about the overall connection of Jews in, in the Muslim or Christian world on the Iberian Peninsula. So that's the whole notion of intermediaries. But I very much focused on this idea. This is a clear sign that Jews have been accepted and integrated because they made use of the language. And of course, at the end of the 18th century, Jews living in Germany also thought about the need to completely embrace German as the language of education to become integrated. And that's one of the calls at the end of the 18th century from the Christian side, so mainly from Dohm, who talked about the civic improvement of the Jews, referring to the need of the Jews to speak German and integrate through language.
So linguistics was very important. And yet the German Jews are looking at a period that saw great assimilation, catastrophe, and even loss when they're looking at the Iberian Peninsula.
Yeah.
I wonder if you might want to address that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, when I studied all this material, usually it's sometimes really troubling to read it, because at some point, some of the authors, the German Jewish authors, were so fascinated with assimilation. For example, Isaac Marcus Jost, who really thought, when looking back, well, actually, it would have been a great idea if the Jews would have assimilated, and he means converted, to Christianity, because then they would really become part of Spanish society, and also, his argument, then if Spanish society would have done that more cleverly, so to speak, integration / conversion, it's really about conversion, then also Spain would have benefited from that. So this is a little bit troubling if you read that, this whole appreciation of assimilation. But to be fair, there were others like Abraham Geiger, who was also very much interested in having Jews integrated, assimilated, but he is, of course, not talking about conversion to Christianity. So we have all kinds of voices in this spectrum in the 19th century. And when it comes to expulsion or oppression, and to be frank, I mean, this golden age did not last longer than maybe 150, 200 years, from 900 up to maybe 1150, 1170 on the Iberian Peninsula. And after that, also under Islam, there were many groups who were very much interested in converting non-Muslims to Islam. So it's not any longer a golden age. But in the perception, we basically see still the focus on it's possible to live together in a non-Jewish majority culture. To some extent, the argument has been made religion became evil, yeah, and Jews were persecuted because of these radical tensions in Islam, but also later in Christianity, when the Jews were finally expelled at the end of the 15th century. So sometimes I thought while writing the book, it's also something like first of all, it's a monologue. So I think German Jews really hoped to create an interest among non-Jews in Germany in the history of the Jews on the Iberian Peninsula, namely that Jews were integrated and they contributed to majority society, but very few non-Jews really went into that conversation, which is troubling. It's a kind of a monologue, really. Yeah. And then we have also a monologue amongst the Jews who wrote to themselves about this glorious past, also to ensure that can also hopefully happen to us. So I'm not talking about expulsion, but hopefully disintegration. You're completely right. There's, whenever the expulsion had been discussed in Gretz's work, and Gretz talks about the expulsion, usually he points all blame on the clergyman who had a very negative impact on, let's say, Isabella, Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. So the people, that's what I sense, are described in Gretzen's work as decent. They were not anti-Jewish, but they were basically manipulated by religious fanatics. So it's also an argument that in an enlightened era or post-enlightened era, where Jews hope to live in Germany, this will never come into being. So, yeah, it's a sign of being aware of religious hatred, but they really believed in the 19th century Germany, this cannot happen. I mean, this will never happen. And also, I have not discussed that in the English version. We are just discussing in this podcast interview, but in the German version, I have a chapter on Zionist responses to that, and Zionists, of course, clearly criticized Sephardic Jews for being too much assimilated.
Now, you describe in the book that the Sephardic diaspora continued to model cultural mediation. Mm-hmm. I think you were talking about the Netherlands, Hamburg, and the Ottoman Empire. Can you tell us a little about this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I found most of the interesting, discussions, role model, counter model, also reflected in the Sephardic diaspora. So those Jews who left Spain either directly in 1492, mainly to North Africa and the Ottoman Empire, and those who later in the 17th century went to Amsterdam and Hamburg. Of course, the latter ones already underwent internal transformation, living as Catholics in Spain and to some degree still practicing Jewish rituals. And the interesting thing is, what I found out in the book is that German Jews became very much aware of this situation, and they became also much more self-confident during the 19th century. So keep in mind, they were still not citizens in Germany, not before 1871. But sometimes it appears to the reader, and not just to me, that they had this very strong feeling of being integrated, and they hoped to become integrated by cultural means at some point. So Abraham Garber, for example, criticizes now contemporary Sephardic Jews who lived in Amsterdam for their, isolation. So he argues, usually one might think, I just reference Geiger, that the Sephardic Jews living in diaspora would now be ideal leaders to all Jews in Europe. But they didn't do anything to actively get involved in politics in the Netherlands. They just looked back to the past without basically being, real active members, I mentioned that already, of society. So he describes them negatively as Spanish hidalgos or lower noblemen who just sit around and rot. They are not active anymore. So, and in Gaia's perception, as well as in other individuals' view, the German Jews had replaced the Sephardic Jews to some degree while living in Germany. And I think the interesting point is that we also have this famous episode when one of the most eminent German Jews, Ludwig Philipson, who was also the editor of the General Journal of Judaism, who wrote a lot about Iberian Sephardic history in scholarly journals, but also on a more popular level, really formulated the idea, first of all, and then ultimately petitioned the Spanish government to allow freedom of religion to be introduced again. And I set again in brackets because that didn't exist before that time. And what he meant by that is when freedom of religion is introduced again to Spain, then the Jews would be allowed to settle again in Spain. So he did petition the Spanish government, the Cortes. Nothing came really out of that, not during his lifetime, so not in 1854. But it gives you an idea that men like Philipson, who worked together with French Jews, that there's a perception we Jews living in Germany are now in charge of making aware nations such as Spain that they have a chance to redo history and become also integrated in this, I mean, perception of being part of enlightened Europe. I mean, that's the argument. And also, most Jews, I mean, the sources, they talk about, to some extent, about Jews and their situation in Germany, but it's mainly about the overall culture. If Spain would admit Jews again to Spain, that's Philipson's argument, and others followed him, then Spain's economy would become better, and Spain would become highly accepted country again. So that is also, I think, for me, there was a very fascinating finding, this, self-confidence, and basically writing to a foreign government, so to speak, and telling them what should be changed.
Yes, it's quite fascinating, and he was perhaps 150 years ahead of his time in doing so.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Very interesting.
And maybe he's also, I just think about that, I mean, maybe he's also referring to these, heroes of the Sephardic world that were also perceived as middlemen who had a chance to talk to kings and queens and try to, I mean, better the situation of the Jews. So maybe he's also really seeing himself in line with these Sephardic heroes of the past, but now he's really coming from Germany and with the help of some French agencies, he was really making this international campaign possible. I mean, that's really how we should term it, I guess.
Yes, fascinating. At a time when the Jews in German lands themselves didn't have full citizenship rights, he's petitioning the Spanish Parliament. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really amazing. But I mean, maybe that's how, I mean, sometimes it works that way, I guess. So, but again, I really believe, in particular at the beginning, there's some hope among German Jews to have some kind of a dialogue about the participation of the Jews in European history. And so that also focus on the Spanish example. But there is not a real discussion, not a real dialogue in that. I mean, even the opposite. I mean, some Christian writers like Fries and Ruse basically understood the Spanish example in their eyes as very strong German nationalistic writers as a proof that the Jews would basically destroy the economy, would destroy the country because they cannot be assimilated. So there's a very, heated debate. I mean, not so much a debate, but basically from these German sources I just mentioned, who argue, no, that's not possible. I mean, Jews cannot become integrated. They cannot contribute. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe something else to be aware of. In particular, during the Romantic era, the concept of a nation and becoming part of it, becoming integrated based on culture, is significantly changing. And so these wonderful words about integration and the idea of becoming integrated, it's really a small gap in history at the end of the 18th century when Dohm wrote his piece on the betterment of the Jews. And then after the French Revolution, all these Romantic authors, German authors, turned to the negative and became very much hostile or indifferent towards Jews and the situation of the Jews in Germany. I mean, that is also something to be aware of, I think.
Yes, it's very interesting. You've mentioned the monologue that, perhaps sadly or tragically, was in place instead of a dialogue. And I think you begin the book with a reference to the Oranienburgstrasse synagogue, the Neue Synagogue, and perhaps the distinct ways in which Jews and perhaps Christians in Berlin responded to that, which seems perhaps to encapsulate some of what you've just shared with us, where Jews perhaps look to the Moorish aspects of the synagogue architecture as an exemplar. And I should let you explain it instead of my doing it. Why don't you share that for our listeners?
Exactly. I mean, when the new synagogue at Berlin, Oranienburger Straße, was, built, up to this day, it's clearly a monument that is directly reflecting this Moorish influence. And it was, a sign for Jews living in Germany, first of all, that they proudly perceived themselves, as Jews living in Germany, but they choose, a style, architectural style for their synagogue that, of course, is, very much different from, let's say, the Gothic style that existed before that among synagogues being built in Germany. And we find, these synagogues even in the United States. So there's some kind of a universal interest in the Sephardic role model also when pointing on the synagogue. So I didn't touch too much on the synagogue. John Ephraim, in his recent book, focused on synagogues much more than I do. I was more interested in the political debate on what basically emerged as an intellectual idea and became a much more powerful, discussion in terms of what is a good, valid integration and what should be avoided. But it's definitely interesting that there is seemingly more interest in this research on a broader level. And I think you can only understand, my expertise is mainly on German Jewish history. You can only understand German Jewish history if you see that these German Jewish authors, mainly at the end of the 18th and then during the 19th century, these were highly trained individuals, not all of them, but many. So they had access to all kinds of sources, rabbinical sources, liturgical writings, and then they combined it with this new interest in historiography on the subject matter. And yes, they spoke to their situation in Germany, but one really has to keep in mind this transnational aspect. And I think these transnational aspects were already discussed in scholarship before when talking about Eastern European Jews and their role on, their situation or their perception among German-speaking Jews. There are many books on that subject matter. But again, I think it's maybe an interesting shift, and there should be more scholarship, hopefully in the future, also in how far Spanish intellectuals perceived the role of the Jews in Spanish history and how, in the 20th century, German Jews focused on that. So I did a little bit of research on that already, but didn't mention it so much in the book. So this idealization, I think, is something we find in many, many cultures, of course, not only in Jewish culture, but it's something which has been, I would argue, up to this point, very much neglected, or at least not really seen in a comparative manner, as I did in the book, but also, John Ephraim did in his recent book from this year as well.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating that your book from 2011, just recently translated into English, is here on our desks at the same time as John Ephraim's. And I was curious if there's started a good deal more interest in this subject or if it was just happenstance.
For me, as I mentioned in the earlier statement, I mean, I had this one sentence in Ernst Toller's autobiography, a socialist, a lefty, who had no connection to Judaism whatsoever. So there's this one sentence in his autobiography. Well, you can write whatever you want to in your autobiography, I'm sure, and it's all part of your own agenda. But I was impressed by that, and so it never let me go. So when I did all other kind of research, I always had this in mind. That is something I found very much appealing. And I also was a little bit, well, maybe frustrated. I'm not sure this is the right term, but there are very few very good articles on the subject matter. So Iberian Sephardic history, perception among German Jews in the late 18th and 19th century. But I thought it would be really important to look into all these different kind of material to come up with some kind of a comparative conclusion to find out why did they really look into that. And I mean, there are many differences, talking about assimilation, integration, and later Zionists clearly spoke against assimilation, and Nordahl and others clearly pointed on this, what they perceived as a wrong history. Jews didn't know anything about what is the meaning of being Jewish. They became Christians, they completely assimilated, and then they were kicked out. I mean, I summarize it just that way. And that had a huge impact, I think, also then on Zionism, in the perception of assimilation as something very negative. But all in all, there are all these different angles and popularization, and one could think about English Jewish literature on Sephardic role models and things like that. I mean, there's so much. Or in France, I mean, I cannot talk about it in detail because I'm not the expert. So I would hope that much more would come out of the most recent scholarship on the subject matter, definitely.
And let's hope so. We have a lot of good material in front of us already, thanks to your work on this. You note that sources about Iberian Jewish past were available for and influenced a wide swath of German Jewish population, not only the elite. Can you tell us a little bit more about the popular sources of the subject?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the popular sources are mainly focused on something which was very appealing to readers. In journals, but also among those who subscribed to Jewish book clubs and so on. And that is the idea that did focus on presented as an ideal Jewish family life. So the family was able to stay together even during times of hardship, or at least reunite at some point again, and during all these upheavals, maintain a Jewish identity. So I think that's also, I think, very important, because family life, family values are very important during an era in Germany when Jews were not citizens yet. So if you focus on your internal life or read descriptions on well-preserved Jewish family life, that is something you would find in your own household in Germany, hopefully, at this time. So then there were very good selling points. There were love stories between two individuals who came together, and there were very much also ideas that had a very large appeal to an audience. They were less scholarly, but always keeping the narrative mainly in mind. I mean, Jews lived during the Iberian Peninsula, what happened to them. And here I also found sometimes more emphasis on expulsion and what happened during these years of expulsion. That is something you find. And also you find sometimes poems by Philipson himself, who wrote very interesting poem in which he clearly says when the Jews would come back to Spain, then this curse on Spain would also be lifted. And with curse, he's basically referring not on a rabbinical curse, because I didn't find anything which really speaks to a direct curse in that sense, but I might be wrong, but he more speaks on the fact that in Spain, everything would flourish again if the expulsion would be revoked. and everyone could settle there, and also without the pressure of the religion. So religion is also something, it's always well taken if it's basically preserving family life from a Jewish perspective, but it's very negative when it's basically trying to interfere with your communal sense. And so this made these novels bestsellers. They were also in the romantic style, though, these adventure novels. Sir Walter Scott is a huge influence also on these German novels written in German. So you see there's another transnational angle. So the model of romantic novels, adventure novels, for example, by Sir Walter Scott.
Interesting. Thank you. So the Zionists, as you've suggested, perhaps turned this argument on its head or looked at evidence that others were ignoring and saw the Iberian experience, in fact, as proof of the need for a homeland for the Jews. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say a few words about that?
Yeah. I mean, again, this is for pragmatic reasons, and not in the English version, but only in the German version. But I think it's very, very interesting, and I really hope to work more on that in future projects. So the first individual, German, not German Jew, but a German Jew, German-speaking Jew, who became one of the most eminent Zionists, Max Nordau, actually traveled to Spain in the early 1880s. When he traveled to Spain, he makes us believe in his travelogue that when he came to Spain, he didn't know much about Jewish history, but then he walked on different locations on streets and he saw Hebrew inscriptions. And he realized that he was basically walking on a cemetery.
Oh, man.
And from here, he started to rethink the Jewish experience in diaspora. And he came to the conclusion in his early writings in the 1880s, well, the only thing that is basically still there from the Jewish presence in Spain is a dead history. Everything is gone. There's nothing there.
Okay.
So, and then he left that for many years out. But when he gave his Zionist speeches at the beginning of the 20th century, he always comes back to this idea, and then he described it as a Jewish millionaires in Spain who didn't know much, didn't know what is going on. They thought they would be integrated, assimilated. They went to the king's banquets, but then they were finally kicked out. And so he's telling that story mainly, of course, to Zionists, but hopefully also in his idea to those Jews who at this point didn't see that Zionism must be an alternative in order of eyes for a modern Jewish life, because assimilation did not work. So that's not something he's encountering while coming to Spain first in the 1880s, but later in his writings, he's always going back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really the only one I discussed in my book who actually traveled to Spain. And it's a very interesting read. This the book is titled by Nordau From the Kremlin to the Alhambra, or from the Kremlin to the Alhambra.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a large portion on Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the first encounter for him to rethink, of course, the whole history of Jewish integration during history, but mainly during the 19th century, and other than most of the individuals in Germany during the 19th century, he clearly opposed that idea later, not during his journey.
That's fascinating. Among your many interesting observations, you note that German Jews of the past have become models for us today, much like the Iberian Jews were models to German Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say a few words about that?
Well, I had mainly in mind when writing it, I mean, the perspective of the 19th century, so that German Jews at some point believed, well, we are now the new Sephardim. And there are even quotations, direct quotations from the text I studied where German Jews saw themselves as new Sephardim. And that's, I think, part of the self-perception. And of course, later, German Jews were widely perceived as the most enlightened, most integrated Jews are, at least in Europe. Mm-hmm. And even when anti-Semitism became so powerful in Europe at the end of the 19th century, I mean, two countries come to mind, of course, France and Russia. Mm-hmm. There's anti-Semitism in Austria, but this anti-Semitism, I mean, it existed. I don't want to downplay it now, but it didn't have this violent association as anti-Semitism in Russia with the pogroms. American Jewry, I mean, I'm not an expert on that. I think up to World War I, definitely. I mean, the German Jews were perceived as a role model to some extent, but I think in the Americas it already changed by then, and then also the German language with World War I is not any longer, appreciated, so to speak, because of the war. But yes, I mean, definitely this idea, maybe being both, being German and being Jewish, but honestly, the more I think about American Jewish history, and again, as a non-expert, in Germany, we have this very strong notion of it's a Christian state, although you would not call it a Christian state. I mean, let's say in the last quarter, maybe, of the 19th century. But when anti-Semitism becomes so powerful, it's mainly not religious anymore, the arguments against the Jews, but there's still this misunderstanding. I mean, how can it be possible that someone is still Jewish, remains Jewish, and he's also German? You know, it's a little bit different, I think, in the United States because of this separation of church and state. I mean, at least in theory and also in practice, on different layers. In Germany, we don't have that, and so that also leads me to my hopefully new project, which is, I mean, focusing on the question of loyalty in German Jewish culture, and I would like to understand how loyalty, I mean, being loyal to one country, my case study would be Germany, is described in German sources and German Jewish sources. So did Jews and Germans really talk about the same thing? Well, we might say, no, they did not. And that's true. But I really would like to do something like a close reading of the main debates again and also integrate new material on that, because it started early on as some kind of a misunderstanding. And when we go into debates today in Germany about immigration, and I don't want to be too general, but I think there are so many similarities that there is still this overall questioning in German culture. I mean, can it really be possible that someone becomes German? You know, he is a German, he speaks German, but he comes from a different place. So I still see many, many remarks, I mean, not only in the political arena, but from all sides, that I think would make it very important for me as a scholar to go back to the Enlightenment and then into the 19th century to think about the whole complex question of loyalty and the question of loyalty in a culture.
Well, that's fascinating, and I think, Carson, you anticipated my closing question. We've taken a lot of your time, and I always like to finish podcasts by talking about what you're working on. Is this exactly what you are working on now?
Yeah, that's what I'm currently working on. That's the main thing. I would also be interested in doing something more on Zionist and Sephardic Jewry, mainly in the Ottoman Empire. But as far as I can tell right now, there is not a lot of sources I found that speaks to that overall matter. Because Jews in the Ottoman Empire during the 19th century were very much perceived through these Oriental lenses, so not so much as ideal mediators in comparison to this golden age in Spain. So it's a little bit more complex, I believe, but also definitely something I would like to at least think about in the future.
Well, that's fascinating. And I hope whatever you choose to focus on next, that you'll come back to New Books in Jewish Studies and discuss it with us here.
Oh, I would be delighted to do so. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Carsten, for your time. This is fascinating. And let me recommend to our listeners that they acquire a copy of Role Model and Counter Model, The Golden Age of Iberian Jewry and German Jewish Culture During the Era of Emancipation. Thank you so much. And please stay tuned to another issue coming up soon of New Books in Jewish Studies.